for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. Peace Envoy George Mitchell will head to the Middle East this weekend. His trip was postponed last week after a diplomatic rift broke out between the U.S. and Israel. But last night, Israel's prime minister offered the U.S. confidence-building measures that, for now, will allow informal peace talks to move forward. In Pakistan, five Northern Virginia men were charged in an alleged terror plot, and the U.S. is investigating the killing of Americans in Mexico. Joining me in the studio for this week's International Friday News Roundup, Yoki Driesen of the Wall Street Journal, Elise Labbitt of CNN, and Abderrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera Arabic. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Your email goes to drshow@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet, join us on Facebook, or check out our brand new website at drshow.org. Good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
Let's talk about Israel's prime minister calling Hillary Clinton last night. Do we know what he said, Elise?
This was a week after Secretary Clinton offered these demands, I guess demanded, that Prime Minister Netanyahu rescind this controversial East Jerusalem settlement project that we've been talking about all week. Basically, what he said to her was, listen, I can't do it. I really, this is a legal issue. We've already announced the settlement project, but this won't take place for a few years. So it's not an issue right now. And in addition, he offered some confidence-building measures that both the Israelis and the Palestinians could take to kind of get back to these proximity peace talks that we've been talking about. In short, it wasn't everything that Secretary Clinton wanted. It's unclear whether this will satisfy the Obama administration after this insult of Vice President Biden. They're going to meet next week and talk about this when Prime Minister is here. And George Mitchell, the special envoy, is headed to the region for talks with Prime Minister Netanyahu on Sunday.
Abderrahim, you've just come back from Israel. Talk about what Elise called an insult. How it all happened, what the reaction was, and this morning, Charles Krauthammer's comment saying we shouldn't have made such a big deal out of this.
Well, I mean, it was clear that the administration was really miffed that during the vice president's visit to Israel, the announcement was made.
That
basically they're planning to build 1,600 housing units in East Jerusalem, which was a snub to the Obama administration, which had originally, during the early days of the Obama administration, called for a total freeze on settlement building.
Except in East Jerusalem, is that correct?
Originally, the demand was to freeze settlement, period. And then when Netanyahu came to Washington, he had his first meeting at the White House with President Obama. When he went back to Israel, President Obama found out that he actually could not force the hand of Benjamin Netanyahu to effect a total freeze. So there's a long background to this.
And Yoki Driesen, should this have been a big deal or not?
I mean, in the scheme of things, probably not. I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, referring to East Jerusalem, no Israeli would see this part of East Jerusalem as having the same status as the West Bank, and no Israeli government has ever agreed to a construction freeze in East Jerusalem, neither the left nor the right. So the notion that Netanyahu, a right-wing prime minister, would agree to it was always somewhat fanciful. I mean, it's not clear to me, looking at this from the outside, why the decision, I mean, the announcement was made when it was made. I don't think Netanyahu knew about it, because he's not stupid, and it would be an incredibly stupid thing to knowingly do. That said, there's been tension between Netanyahu and Obama on a personal level since they both took office. U.S. officials are open about it. Israeli officials are open about it. Netanyahu famously called David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, two of the president's advisors, self-hating Jews. So there has been a sort of personal background tension to this relationship dating back for months. And this was sort of the final match to that pool of gasoline.
I somewhat agree with that. I don't think it should have come as a surprise that the U.S. and Israel would hit this kind of snag, if you will. It was known even during the Obama election campaign, that there were going to be problems with a Netanyahu government, principally over the issue of settlement. Now, look, the issue of settlement, the Obama administration, and I think Obama himself at some point had referred to it as settlement gluttony. So he makes a distinction between settlement gluttony and the existential security of Israel. To the Obama administration, and I think he's supported by large segments of the Arabs, and to a certain extent by a minority of Israelis, and I think a substantial number of American Jews, to the Obama administration, the issue of settlement in East Jerusalem, is not an issue of existential security for Israel. It's part of settlement gluttony. And from that particular point of view, it was always going to be a problem between Israel and the United States, given the ideological and political directions of the Obama administration.
But clearly the administration has drawn a line in the sand on the issue of settlements. You heard Secretary Clinton several months ago in September, or even before September, when the president met with the parties, and she said, not one brick. And then the Israelis said, well, it's going to be more than one brick. And the United States had to walk it back. They had to walk the Palestinians back. Everything, if you think about it, has been about this issue of settlements. And the administration decided to kind of rise up the rhetoric on this. And I really think that a lot of it has to do with the administration's way that it's handled the settlements. Diane, it is amazing that 13 months into this administration, with the transformational agenda that President Obama had, the credibility he had in the Arab world, and all of his goals on the Middle East, that we are where we are with no negotiations, no credibility with the Arabs on the Mideast peace process, and this issue with Israel. And now that the United States decided to make this issue of settlement such a big crisis, it really remains to be seen how it's going to handle this, because we can't go back to exactly where we were before.
Just to add one thing to Elisa's point, you know, she mentioned him coming in with credibility in the Arab world, but he came in with no credibility in Israel. And that's been a huge issue for them since the start. You know, Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, once had a poll rating of 5% approval within Israel. And people thought no one could possibly get lower than that in an approval poll. Well, Obama is rapidly approaching lower than Ehud Olmert. Israelis don't trust him, and Israelis don't like him. And so we talk about credibility in the Arab world, which is important. But if you're trying to push Israel to make a deal, Israel has to feel trust, and they don't.
Actually, Diane, there was a recent poll that said that some of this reporting that coming out of Israel about Obama's all-time like low credibility actually isn't true, and that more Israelis support Obama than you may think. So, you know, the Israeli press has a tendency to kind of continue to reiterate and paint Obama as, you know, dangerous to Israel's security. But the Century Foundation and the New America Foundation and a bunch of other groups spent a lot of money on this one particular poll that said that Obama does have a lot more legitimacy in the Middle East than one may think.
I totally agree with that. I think the animosity towards Barack Obama in Israel has essentially been among the settlers more than the wide Israeli public opinion. But the issue of credibility in Israel, it's a matter of relativity. I mean, remember that President Bush had a lot of credibility in Israel because he basically gave blanket agreement to whatever Israel was doing at that time when he was president. Now you have a new president, who is saying, look, I'm running a war in Afghanistan, I'm running a war in Iraq. I may have to go to war against Iran. And this stuff that the Benjamin Netanyahu government is doing is not helping me. So the credibility issue has to be seen in that context.
And last night, the Israeli military struck six sites in Gaza. How come?
Well, I mean, as grave as the incident seems to have been, I mean, it seems to have been so grave that even the quartet in Moscow took time to actually comment about it. Ultimately, I don't think that, at least at this particular point in time, it's going to amount to a major conflagration between whoever launched the rockets, Hamas or somebody else in Gaza and the Israelis. I mean, but I think the focus here is still the issue of settlement.
So George Mitchell then heads to the Middle East. What kind of approach will he use to try to get these people talking again, Yoki?
What they're talking about is what they refer to as proximity talks, which is itself define it in a second, but to even talk about it is itself a reflection of how far things have deteriorated over the last 13 months. Proximity talks basically is, it's like children in a room where two kids don't get along, so they bring in a third person to pass the note to. And the idea is the Palestinians would be in their territory, and Mitchell would go see them. The Israelis would be in Israel, Mitchell would go see them, and he would shuttle back and forth from side to side, carrying back messages. What it would not be is direct Israeli-Palestinian talks at the same table in the same room.
Yoki Driessen at the Wall Street Journal, Elise Labbitt, senior State Department producer for CNN, and Abderrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. And welcome back to the international portion of our Friday News Roundup this week with Elise Labbitt, a producer for CNN at the State Department, Yoki Driessen of the Wall Street Journal, who has recently returned from Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia, Abderrahim Fukara, he's Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Arabic. Yoki, let's talk about the U.S. Secretary of State in Moscow. She's there for a meeting of the Mideast Quartet. Tell us about that.
The Mideast Quartet was set up some years back as trying to be a sort of outside body to help push forward the peace process and kind of other related issues. We were talking about the idea of a snub a few moments ago and referring to Israel. Arguably what happened in Moscow is a snub potentially of equal or greater importance. As she was arriving, the Russians announced that a nuclear plant in Bushehr that they've been helping the Iranians construct for the last several years, but that is not yet operational, in part because it doesn't have the fuel that it needs to operate, but that Russia announced that it would be providing Iran with the fuel and the last bits of construction help it needs to make the plant operational. The U.S. has long said that civilian nuclear power is not a problem, but that other countries shouldn't help Iran get civilian nuclear power while there are doubts about its military nuclear program. So for this announcement to be made just as she is arriving, I mean, is arguably a snub just as much as the as the Biden incident was in Jerusalem.
Well, and as Secretary Clinton and Foreign Minister Lavrov were standing next to each other, you could see the tension on this particular issue. I mean, she said that they shouldn't give them the fuel. Lavrov said that the plant is going to start this summer as scheduled. And, you know, to Yoki's point, the U.S. has said that Iran should have a civil nuclear program. But now what we're seeing is that they're holding it hostage to resolution on the nuclear issue. And this is part of a kind of administration-wide campaign to turn the heat up on Iran. And it also reflects the kind of fragile partnership that the U.S. and Russia have on Iran and other issues. It seems that they seem to have a kind of growing consensus that Iran's nuclear program is a problem. The Russians have been coming around because the Iranians haven't been embarrassing them. They've always been in Iran's corner on sanctions and things like that. And Iran hasn't come to the table with any of these proposals to accept them. But at the same time, Russia has these economic interests with Iran, commercial ties with Iran, that they're not ready to give up. So it's a very fragile partnership, I'd say.
So, Abderrahim, do you believe the U.S. is getting any closer to accepting the reality of Iran as a nuclear power?
Well, I mean, first of all, just to pick up on what Elise said a little while ago about the fragile partnership, I mean, it is the partnership between the Russians and the Americans, it seems to be so fragile in so many different ways, which takes me back to what Yoki said about comparing the snub in Russia and in Israel. In my personal view, they do not compare. They do not compare for in the sense that what do you expect from the Russians? From the Israelis, though, because the Israelis owe so much to the United States, even when it comes to their existential security, as they describe it, for them to snub the vice president of the United States, I don't think that amounts to the Russians snubbing Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Just back for a moment. Do you believe, as Yoki does, that the prime minister of Israel did not know that this decision had been made?
I mean, I find that hard to believe that he didn't know. But you know, that has become almost inconsequential now. The fact is, even the U.S. administration, whether it's President Obama or Vice President Joe Biden, have referred to it as a decision by the Israeli government and not just by the Interior Ministry.
And Netanyahu didn't really make any efforts to walk it back immediately. If he didn't know, if he wasn't responsible for the announcement, at least he could have done something to say, hey, wait a minute, this is not my fault.
All right, so back to the question I asked you regarding Iran.
Yes, I mean, the issue of I'm sure the Iranians are feeling the heat of what Secretary Clinton is trying to do. But again, as Elise said a little while ago, the Russians have so many different interests in Iran. Some of them are economic, some of them are geopolitical. Iran is so central to stability in Russia's neighborhood that I doubt if the Iranians would play along the way that Secretary Clinton wants them to play along, either in terms of punishing sanctions or further down the road if there's talk of military action. It seems to me that the Iranians at this particular point in time do not take the threat of military action seriously. And in that sense, I think there's a sense that if they are ultimately planning to build a nuclear weapon, they still feel that they have plenty of room to maneuver. And let's remember that the U.S. is actually planning to withdraw its troops from neighboring Iraq, which would actually give the Iranians a lot more leverage in terms of their influence in the region.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there's a lot in there that I disagree with in terms of the Iran-Russia-Israel question. To start with, to the U.S., to Washington, Israeli settlements are an irritant. This administration believes them to be something that threatens American security interests, but they do not see them as an existential threat. To this administration and to most of the previous administrations, a nuclear Iran is a threat of a much greater magnitude. Similarly, in talking about snub or lack of a snub, Obama took office and very famously had Joe Biden say they wanted to push the reset button with Russia. Obama has tried very, very, very hard to build closer ties with Russian President Medvedev. He's tried very hard to get U.S.-Russian ties closer. Secretary Gates, when he was traveling with me last week, said that the U.S. felt that Russia was on board now with tougher sanctions against Iran, that China wasn't, but that Russia was. So within the administration, there's some feeling of optimism. But Iran to this administration is a huge, huge security concern. They're overarching one for the whole region. And when they believe Russia's on board and they get to Russia and Russia publicly says, we're not, that is an enormous snub and an enormous setback.
All right. And there's another very serious concern to the United States regarding these killings in Mexico. What happened there, Yoki?
It's really a horrible case in every possible dimension, particularly the human one. But it was several cars heading back from a child's birthday party right over the border in Ciudad Juarez. People drove up to both cars, separate shooters, and riddled them both with bullets. And the car that is the more concern right now to the U.S., an American consulate employee and her husband were both killed. She was pregnant. They had a baby in the back seat and a safety seat who watched this all happen and was thankfully unhurt, but will now grow up without parents or a sibling. But I think the barbarity of it, first off, but just the simple fact of an American citizen being killed by what appears to be the narco-terrorists who are destabilizing Ciudad Juarez so terribly, it's pushed Mexico, which has been sort of a second-tier concern, given how preoccupied the U.S. is with other things, it's pushed it higher.
Is there any indication that this could have been a mistake on the part of the narco terrorists, believing they were targeting people who were somehow involved with the narco terrorism themselves?
Well, there are some reports that there are a mistaken identity, but there are equally enough. And the Mexican ambassador actually did an interview on CNN, said that yesterday, and he said it didn't indicate that the investigation didn't indicate so far that the consulate itself and people involved with the consulate were targeted. But there are just as many reports that say that this was to send a message to the U.S. and Mexico, because violence is very common in Juarez. It's a key drug entry point, and there's a lot of violence there. But violence against Americans is really unusual, and violence against a U.S. employee, a government employee, is even more unusual, and it just kind of illustrates that this is a real national security threat for the United States. Next week, Secretary Clinton, Secretary Gates, Napolitano, the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Dennis Blair, and officials from DEA, the Office of Drug Control Policy, a real who's who of U.S. national security figures are going to be in Mexico next week to discuss the Merida Initiative, which is a program that the U.S. has with Mexico, over $1 billion in aid to help them fight the drug war. And I think, you know, this was set before the killings. But the fact that you have so many administration heavyweights dealing
high
with
level
this drug issue shows that the U.S. sees it as a real national security
threat. So I would think you'd have a lot more intelligence sharing after these killings.
I would imagine so, but I think that my sense is that the challenge that is being felt in both Washington and in Mexico City is huge. I mean, in many ways, it's an embarrassing situation for the Mexican government, because you get a lot of people talking about the collapse of the state of law in northern Mexico. And if you have a collapse of the state of law in northern Mexico, then what does the U.S. Try to do about it, given that Mexico is not only a sovereign state, it's an ally? Do you send your troops into northern Mexico? What do you do?
Do you send agents into Mexico?
There already are a very large number of DEA and FBI agents already in Mexico, and that number has grown after the shootings. You know, what's interesting is that the last time I think the U.S. as a country kind of started to pay attention to the border, it was a year or so ago when immigration was a big heated political issue. And you had, you know, the Minutemen going to the border with lawn chairs and binoculars trying to spot illegal immigrants. The whole thing was kind of farcical. But when you're in the Southwest or you talk to people who live in the Southwest, the concern now isn't just the immigration concern, you know, that which is a political issue, but it's a security concern. I mean, the border between Rio and Ciudad Juarez last year had 500 murders, which is more than most American cities that are multiple times as big. Rio had like 10 or 15. It was a much smaller number. But they're separated, as you know, just by a river. So the concern is, how long can it possibly be when you have this much violence in Mexico, when the border is pretty much non-existent between the two, before that violence starts to go up as well. So the border becomes not just an immigration question, but a security question of, do you start seeing narco-violence, shootings, kidnappings, torture, all the things you see on the Mexico side, on the American side as well.
And it's spring break time. All Americans love to go down to Mexico. The U.S. has a travel warning to avoid these border towns, but it does send a kind of larger issue to Americans about going to Mexico.
At all.
And I think one of the problems is, for the last year, and even before under the Bush administration, the U.S. did support President Calderon's effort to really go against these drug cartels. And we have seen, you know, some success. But we've also seen, you know, the cartels fighting for the remaining vestiges of power. We've seen a lot of violence. And now I think that there's I don't think there's any conclusions, but really everyone's examining whether we've reached a tipping point on this strategy, if whether, you know, it's the kind of law of diminishing returns. If the violence is going to increase, then really we may need to think of something new.
And there's going to be a state dinner for Calderon here in Washington quite soon. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's talk about the Iraq election results. We still have no final tally on these votes up there, Aim.
Yes, the counting is still going on, and there are obviously conflicting reports coming out of, or at least conflicting interpretations of what's going on in Iraq. One interpretation is that no matter what the security challenges are, Iraq has definitely crossed a security threshold. You now have Iraqis actually going to the polls to fight the fight rather than fight it out on the streets. But the other interpretation is that given the results that have come out so far, the signs are not encouraging that sectarian strife is over and done with in Iraq. The tension between Iyad Alawi, the former prime minister, and Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki representing the Shiites, Iyad Alawi, who is, although he is a Shiite, he's actually representing the Sunnis in this election, it has come down to political sectarian strife in this election.
Well, they're neck and neck, and whoever party receives the greatest number of votes is going to have a chance to try and form a coalition. And that's when the real horse racing begins, the post-election jockeying to build a coalition. And this could cause some tensions. But I was just speaking to some U.S. officials in Baghdad this morning, and some might call it sectarianism. Others might call it politics. These are politicians that are trying to jockey for position and influence. And I heard everybody is up going to visit the Kurds. And the question remains, what's going to happen when you have a winning party? Who is going to be is that person going to accept the results? Alawi might accept the results. But if Maliki loses by a few votes, he has a big constituency in the country. Is he going to stand down? And that's when we might start to see some conflicts.
And just to let you know, we've just learned that President Obama is going to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Tuesday. Fox News has learned as a sharp disagreement over settlements continues to fester. Netanyahu is coming to the U.S. for the AIPAC conference. Is that going to make a difference, Yoki?
Well, I mean, the timing is always such a painful, bizarre thing. So the timing of this housing announcement while Biden was there, the timing of this fight happening before AIPAC. I mean, the headline speaker scheduled from the administration was Hillary Clinton, who had always had a fairly warm relationship with AIPAC and gotten a lot of applause in previous speeches. But it remains to be seen, given how tense her phone call was, how public her criticism has been, it remains to be seen what kind of reaction she would get when she goes to speak to AIPAC in a few days.
And what about the president? Is he not expected to speak at AIPAC?
He's not expected to speak at AIPAC. Usually it's the vice president, presidents have in the past. But I think that the fact that the president is meeting with Netanyahu is pretty remarkable. I thought we were going to see some kind of day trip by President Obama because he wasn't available, because that's what we saw last year. And I think it shows that the administration wants to kind of walk it back, calm things down, and repair relations so that they could get to the real goal, which is to start these talks.
I mean, you have to remember one thing, that in the 90s, when Benjamin Netanyahu was prime minister of Israel, the Clinton administration politically staged a coup, and his government at that time toppled. And I'm sure that as he's navigating these waters, he's thinking about that. To what extent is the Barack administration planning a similar thing to push the current government, the current right-wing government, to collapse so that Benjamin Netanyahu can bring in Kadima and Labour? I don't know, but Benjamin Netanyahu must surely be thinking about that.
Yogi?
It's true that in 1996 we had this weird moment where Clinton signaled very publicly that they preferred Shimon Peres, who was running against Netanyahu, which was tremendously unusual and unpopular. It's also worth remembering, since Netanyahu is getting bashed on a bit in the show, that the only deals signed in the 90s as far as peace treaties were signed by Netanyahu, not by the left-wing governments that followed.
Yogi Dresden of the Wall Street Journal. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Emily and Antoine von Ochtmal, supporting New Futures, a D.C.-based organization committed to transforming lives through learning. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with songwriter, guitarist, and singer Alex Chilton. He died Wednesday at the age of 59. As a teenager, he recorded the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby with the Box Tops. Later, he co-founded the band Big Star. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And it's time to open the phones. We'll go first to Tony in Oklahoma City. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
I keep hearing in the media the violence in Ciudad Juarez as being referred to as drug violence. And to me, it's no more drug violence than the same Valentine's Day massacre was alcohol violence. That Hillary Clinton made a statement that the violence is caused by America's insatiable appetite for the illegal drugs that are smuggled, but she left out an important point, that Americans want the drugs that their government doesn't want them to have. I'll listen to the comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I think the caller makes an interesting point in the sense that the secretary and others have really the American demand for drugs, especially coming from Mexico and Colombia and all these programs, countries where the U.S. has programs, is insatiable. And that's part of the U.S. responsibility to have to help Mexico deal with this problem. Another problem is the money and guns that are coming from the United States that are going to Mexico. And that's one of the main things that the U.S. is trying to work on right now, which is try to stop the money and guns that are fueling the drug cartels down there.
All right. To Petchog, New York. Willine, you're on the air.
Yes, good day to you all.
Hello.
It's my understanding that the 12 of the leading Mexican authoritarians who are working with against the drug cartels have had to have RFID chips inserted into their bodies in case of capture or kidnapping. And this is tantamount to Big Brother. But I guess that they have to do what they have to do. I'll take my comment off the air.
Have you heard anything along those lines, Yoki?
No, I have not.
Has anyone?
No, I haven't.
I wonder if this is an urban legend or whether it is something that is known within that area. Sorry, no confirmation here. Let's go to Lanham, Maryland. Jews, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Fantastic show.
Thank you.
Number one, I think it's time for AIPAC to face reality because they influence decision here that affects a lot of people who are in the war zone or conflict area. It becomes incumbent for AIPAC to speak to Israeli government to realize that America is sacrificing so much. For instance, I believe if Netanyahu did not, if the interior minister did not do what they did, I don't think Russia would have done exactly what was done to Hillary Clinton. And American soldiers, according to what is said in the papers, are having a tough time succeeding in the fight against terrorism, partly simply because of the relationship between Israel and America. And to my understanding, America spends about $3 billion a year to Israel. So what is America really getting out of Israel? And American foreign policy is centered around Israel and the Middle East problem. It becomes time for people in power to stand up to the truth. And that's why I give a lot of kudos for Barack Obama to face settlement up front by saying that stop settlement, that's the issue.
All right, Yoki.
The caller raises two really interesting points I'd like to just comment on briefly. The first is that he made the point near the end of his remarks that the U.S. gives Israel $3 billion in aid, which is actually probably an understatement. I think it's a bigger number, actually, which is true. Right now, this administration has a big request, though, that it wants from Israel in return. And what it wants is for Israel to hold off on any kind of military action against Iran, precisely for the other point the caller made, which is that there are U.S. soldiers fighting and dying in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the belief universally within the Pentagon is that an Israeli strike would make those wars more dangerous and make American casualties more likely. So it isn't normally that you can say there's a one-sided nature to it. Here there's a very, very big American request in return. But there's an interesting moment last week. General David Petraeus, who is hands down the most well-known American military official in the world, talked on Capitol Hill about a report he had given to the Pentagon some weeks back in which he said basically that the lack of progress on the Israel-Palestinian peace process has a direct impact on American national security. Now, that point is not a shocking point kind of in itself, but it's very unusual to hear an American general make that point, let alone one of the prominence of David Petraeus. So the debate now is it wasn't simply a sort of civilian official to civilian official, you know, an Obama to Netanyahu, a Hillary Clinton to Netanyahu, but it was joined by the military as well, which adds a whole new complexion because if you're a senator on Capitol Hill, you might feel easier bashing the White House over Israel. You probably won't feel as easy about bashing the Pentagon if it says the same thing.
Yoki, you were just in Afghanistan. What's going on in Marja? Was the offensive there a success?
It's a great question, and it's sort of the $64,000 understates it because we spent hundreds of millions, so it's the $100 million question. And right now, there's no way to know. The U.S. had this unusual strategy of announcing it ahead of time, which meant that there was actually very little fighting because most of the insurgents had fled weeks earlier. So on the one hand, the U.S. retook the town fairly easily, casualties were very low. Afghan casualties were very low. U.S. controls the whole town. On the other hand, there's an interesting New York Times story talking about how the Taliban have come back at night to intimidate, to behead, to beat up. So the question with a place like Marja is always not can you push them out, but can you keep them from climbing back in? And it's way too early to say that we can do that successfully.
But aren't they also making their presence felt in northern Afghanistan?
They are. And what you see is this question of whether the war in Afghanistan is basically a war against the Pashtun wherever they are. Because if you look at a map of Kunduz, which is where the fighting is in the north, the areas within Kunduz that are violent are the Pashtun-dominated areas of Kunduz, in the same way that the Pashtun-dominated areas of the east and of the south is, again, where the fighting is heaviest. So what you see is sort of this weird, interesting, ethno-sectarian dynamic to the Afghan war, where it's the Pashtun group that we're basically at war with throughout the country and not any of Afghanistan's other ethnic minorities.
I thought it was also interesting to hear from CIA Director Leon Panetta that he feels we're really making progress with al-Qaeda and that Osama bin Laden is sort of in greater depth of hiding.
Allow me, first of all, just to briefly say something about AIPAC. There was a time until very recently, at least in the Middle East, and I assume here in the United States as well, when AIPAC was synonymous with Israel. And currently, as far as I can make out, there's a debate going on about whether AIPAC represents Israel or if it represents the right in Israel. I think the emergence of a J Street here in the United States is a pointer to me that there's an increasing number of people who believe that AIPAC represents the right of in Israel more than Israel as a whole. About what the CIA director said, we've heard these statements before, from even during the Bush administration, that, you know, headway was being made and that a satisfactory conclusion was at hand to the Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri issue. I think what's different this time with the Obama administration is that this statement has been made in the wake of the large-scale military operation by the U.S. and NATO, which certainly seems to lend it credibility. But the pattern that we're seeing now in the fight in Afghanistan is reminiscent somewhat of what we saw in Iraq. You beat them here, you beat the insurgents here, and they'll pop up somewhere else, which raises the question of to what extent can you bring the civilians in Afghanistan, as was the case in Iraq, to cooperate with NATO and the United States. And we know from the news about intimidation by the Taliban what a mammoth-sized challenge that's going to be for the West.
Yogi, what about this drone strike that killed Hussein al-Yemeni in Pakistan last week?
It's interesting. This is a kind of rare point of CIA pride. I mean, the CIA typically says next to nothing. It allows the news to kind of filter out, but in this case, you had Leon Panetta come not quite up to the line of saying, yes, we did it, but to talk openly about, yes, he was killed, and kind of leave implied strongly who did the killing. And what you've seen in the last couple of months is this tremendous expansion of the number of U.S. drone strikes into Pakistan. It's really very interesting. When Obama took office, George Bush had the reputation of this warlike president. Obama had this reputation of this somewhat aloof professor. And at least in Pakistan, the number of drone strikes under Obama is exponentially higher than it was under Bush, and they've had success. They've killed al-Yemeni, they had killed Batula Masood some months back, the then leader of the Pakistani Taliban. So you've seen, on the one hand, Pakistan allowing more U.S. strikes, and on the other, the strikes being a lot more accurate.
All right, to Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Diane. I'll try to give you just a common man's interpretation of what I'm seeing over in the Middle East and then speak on Mexico, and I'll be brief. To me, it really appears the Israelis are pretty much too big for their britches. The Russians are insulted by our infringement on their suzerainty. The Iranians are intransigent, and the Arab community thinks that we're hypocrites, and I really think we can kill four birds with one stone if we would just back off, you know. just don't even bother with the Iranian issue right now. Let Russia deal with it. The Israelis will realize that they need to think a little bit more about cooperation. The Arabs will start to look at us in a different light. But that's a common man's view. And also, in Mexico, I really think that it's time that we consider legalizing marijuana. The percentage of the trade in drugs from Mexico is so high that we're the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and hoping for a different reason or hoping for a different outcome.
Thanks for calling, Paul. Back to that legalization issue over and over again, but also back off. Let Russia deal with it. What do you think, Elise?
Well, I think there are a couple of threads to the caller's first part of his comments, which is about the loss of influence that the United States is facing around the world, in Israel, in the Middle East, in the Arab world. I mean, the United States, the one thing that the United States had its credibility for was the ability to deliver Israel, was the ability to kind of bring Israel to the table. You know, the Europeans or the Russians or the Arabs could help with the Palestinians. But the U.S. credibility was always about Israel. And if we can't deliver Israel, that really calls into question the kind of U.S. ability to be the kind of uber-honest broker that I think everyone – it's historically played and everyone wants it to
Yogi.
Play.
I think that's a fair point, although to the caller's hope that if the U.S. withdrew, Russia would deal with Iran – I think that that's just nonsensical. I mean, the Russian view is that the Iranian nuclear issue is a threat to the U.S. It's a threat to Israel. It is not a threat to Iran. So their economic interests are more important. Their natural gas interests are more important. To the degree that anyone in the world is serious about Iran, it's the U.S. first and foremost, Israel second and second most, if that's a word. But the idea that if we left it to its own devices, it would be miraculously solved by Russia or Europe, it just doesn't track with reality.
And Abderrahim, how much do you think it would help in this situation with Mexico and other countries, Afghanistan, if we simply legalized marijuana in this country?
I mean, I don't think the issue here is just about marijuana. I think the issue is it was about, you know, much more serious and much more dangerous drugs. And I just go back to what Elise said a little while ago. I mean, part of the problem is the supplier-consumer issue. As long as you have consumers, you will always have suppliers. Now, the thread that leads to Afghanistan, I mean, there's a lot of opium cultivation in Afghanistan, for example. And we know from the case of Afghanistan, just to extrapolate to Latin America, we know from the case of Afghanistan that it's so hard to combat the drugs at the source, because that's basically what people have in Afghanistan to make a living, to survive, is to produce opium. To some extent, I think that's the case in Latin America.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And finally, to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Bennett. You're on the air.
Yes. I heard on the radio that a power play by Pakistan in arresting these Taliban leaders has interrupted negotiations that were going on between Afghanistan and the coalition to deal with the Taliban. And is that true?
It's a really interesting question. What the caller is referring to quite accurately is the arrest of a guy named Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, who is basically the operations chief of the Taliban, their number two. The U.S. has killed about 100 of the Taliban number three, which is the most dangerous job in the world. Now they've captured the number two. There's been a lot of reporting, primarily in the Afghan press, sometimes in the European press, that Baradar, who was seen as somewhat of a moderate, had been having back-channel talks with Hamid Karzai. The background to this is Hamid Karzai has publicly said he wants to have a peace conference this spring in which the Taliban senior leadership would maybe it'd be invited to participate. The U.S. thinks that's frankly kind of crazy, that the Taliban think they're winning and they won't come to the table until they think they're losing, and right now they don't. But Hamid Karzai is determined that there should be some sort of public peace talks. Baradar was seen as kind of the private envoy back and forth between the two sides.
And also, just very recently, in the last 24 hours, the former UN special envoy to Afghanistan, Kai Aidi, told the BBC that the UN was facilitating talks with the Taliban and that this arrest of Mullah Bardar has really hurt the effort. And so it's not just about kind of some reporting that's out there. He's on record saying that this has damaged it. But the U.S., while it supports kind of reintegration of rank-and-file Taliban, it's unclear whether they're going to support the kind of major leaders that would be interested in reconciliation. And it's unclear whether they want that.
A late slap at Senior State Department producer for CNN, Yoki Driessen. He's military correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Abderrahim Fukara. He's Washington Bureau Chief of Al Jazeera Arabic. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.